seeing Abington. Her time was her own, and Carrie could still work his case. Take that, Dr. Goodwin. Carrie squeezed into the crowded elevator. Her finger hovered over the button to the medical ICU floor before she resisted the temptation. It was one thing to do some research in the library on a TERFed patient, but she couldn't flagrantly ignore Dr. Goodwin's instructions minutes after they had been issued. It was best for now to keep her investigation academic. The library at the VA was located on the first floor, just off the lobby, and it did not look like it got much use. The floor was covered with a threadbare carpet, and though it had a few wooden carrels, none had a chair. Unlike the gift shop, which was staffed by volunteers dressed in brightly colored smocks adorned with patriotic pins, the library reception desk was unattended. In place of a human, a sign in an acrylic holder provided instructions on how to obtain a password to access the computer and navigate to the homepage. Some of the more recent medical journals, what limited print supply was on hand, were stuffed haphazardly into a standing magazine rack, but the library shelves were notably barren. Carrie located a plastic chair and set it facing a terminal. A thought of her dad flashed across her mind. How would he go about this? Her father loved doing research. To him, it was a major part of the challenge of medicine. He and Carrie could not have been more different in this regard. As a surgeon, Carrie preferred her puzzle pieces manifested not as words, but rather lab results, machine readouts, and whatever visual cues she could derive from inside the human body. She was typical of the field. Few surgeons loved doing research. Carrie recalled her third year in medical school during her clinical clerkship, when she was on hospital rounds with the attending physician and a host of medical interns and residents. The resident would summarize the previous day's events, what the blood work or imaging studies revealed, while the rest hovered over the patient's bedside like spectators at a sporting event. While these bedside rounds may have been a bit intrusive, they were always interesting and instructive. Until, that is, some suck-up student or resident would inevitably blurt out something like, "Thompson et al. In last week's Lancet." Then they'd go into detail about some study that was published and how it might relate to the patient before them. Inwardly, Carrie would groan her displeasure. To Carrie, rounds on surgical services were about practical information and hands-on study. The book learning, though important, was no longer the focus. Instead, her attention was on the ins and outs of active treatment. She held nothing but respect for internal medicine docs, or fleas, as the surgeons called them. Her dad was one, for goodness sake, and he would always be her idol. But from day one, Carrie felt more comfortable in her skin as a surgeon. An old joke came to mind. An internal medicine doc, a pathologist, and a surgeon are out duck hunting. Suddenly, a flock of birds goes by. The internist says, "They quack like ducks, they fly like ducks, they've got the coloring of ducks, they're probably ducks." The surgeon glances over at his friend, raises his shotgun, and shoots the birds out of the sky. Then he says to the pathologist, "Go see if they're ducks." Carrie was a surgeon. After about a minute of aimless clicking and browsing, Carrie called her dad.
"Hi, sweetie," Howard Bryant said.
Carrie smiled at the sound of his voice.
"Hi, Dad. I could use some help."
After she'd explained what she was after, Carrie's father pinpointed the problem. She was at the wrong library. It felt liberating to walk out the front doors of the VA, leaving the building Dr. Goodwin occupied, for the Orange Line T-stop. Carrie could have driven to the Harvard Medical Library, but parking at this time of day would be a hassle. 30 minutes later, Carrie traded the warm spring day for the cool interior of the Francis A. Countway Library of Medicine. The Harvard Library was a sprawling multi-floor building with a winding marble staircase and a spacious courtyard gloriously situated beneath a massive atrium ceiling. It took Carrie some time to find the Index Medicus, which had stopped publication in 2004, toppled by medical search engines, but respecting her dad's library research attack plan, she'd start with the tried and true. 2 hours into her effort, Carrie still had not found anything useful, but she remained dedicated to the task. It was some relief that Carrie could find no cases of DBS-induced arrhythmia, which quieted the voice in her head that wanted to blame her for that part of Abington's condition. As for his delirium, the medical search engines offered up a host of unusual types of hallucinations that took her nowhere. Hypnagogic hallucinations associated with sleep stage alterations, peduncular hallucinosis associated with brainstem diseases, muscular hallucinations that seemed more benign and could even be pleasurable, but nothing that seemed like Abington's case.
Carrie examined a few old textbooks, Noyes' Modern Clinical Psychiatry from the 60s.
Useless.
She got up to stretch her legs. Another hour slipped by, and then another. Carrie's stomach was rumbling, but she was not ready to stop. She recalled the pure terror on Abington's face as she filled out a reference request card for an obscure medical journal. Her hunger for lunch seemed small next to the needs of the patient.
"I'll be sitting over there," Carrie said to the delicate and bony 80-year-old woman working the desk, who hefted enormous tomes with seemingly little effort.
"I'll get it for you, I'll get it for you," the librarian said, repeating her words in what was probably a lifelong habit.
It reminded Carrie of Abington. Follow my light. Follow my light. That was when it struck her. Carrie had been so focused on calling Abington's symptoms hallucinations that she had found articles specific only to that condition. But Abington was not exhibiting hallucinations. These were not totally false perceptions. It was more of a misperception of what Carrie had said. She asked him a question, and he had responded multiple times. He only thought she was saying it over and over again, when in fact she had uttered it only once, a simple single phrase. As a neurosurgeon, Carrie was well aware of the difference between an illusion and a hallucination. She had focused on the wrong issue. A hallucination is a false perception, with no external stimulus involved. Whatever the individual hallucinates is an internal, personal experience. But an illusion is a misperception of reality, and in these cases, an external stimulation is always present. With Abington, the external stimulation was Carrie's voice. Carrie raced back to her desk and grabbed a standard textbook, Principles of Neurology by Adams and Victor. She had already read up on hallucinations, but this time she aimed elsewhere. Illusions. Carrie rifled through the index until she found Illusions, Auditory, page 759. There, down toward the bottom of the page, was a reference to auditory illusions associated with lesions of the temporal lobe, where words may be repeated, a kind of perseveration. Yes, perseveration, the uncontrolled repetition of a word or phrase that was associated with brain injury. He was not hearing things, but rather he had a misperception of what was heard. It was a subtle twist, but it made all the difference. Carrie's pulse jumped. She was onto something. She read about palynacusis, a condition first described by Bender in 1965 and elaborated by Jacobs with a number of case studies in 1973. It came from the Greek, palyn, again, and akouen, to hear. All cases were attributed to lesions in the temporal lobe, where sound was processed in the brain. Some cases were due to a form of seizure, like a type of localized epilepsy. Single words or more extensive phrases would be repeated several times, in other words, perseverated. The sounds could be even louder and more vivid than the original. Many patients became upset and quite disturbed by the event. Carrie read about several patients who were coherent enough to figure out that the sounds seemed to come from one particular side of their head. As it turned out, doctors were able to determine that instances of palynacusis manifest on the side opposite the brain lesion. If that were true, Abington would have heard Carrie's words, "Follow my light," only in one ear. More accurately, the left auditory field on the opposite side of the lesion. Palynacusis was extremely rare. Carrie could find only a handful of described cases, despite an extensive literature search. She spent some time contemplating possible reasons why Abington had developed the condition. He certainly did not exhibit it prior to surgery. Then again, he was not in any coherent state during her pre-op exam. Perhaps he was having the illusion then. Maybe that had triggered his rage. Could it have been seizure-related? Or did he have a hemorrhage in the temporal lobe post-op? The amygdala was not in the anatomical area that processed sounds, but could the DBS have done this in some indirect way? Carrie's head was spinning. Was this auditory illusion somehow connected to the arrhythmia, or did the haloperidol bring it on? Perhaps it was a combination of factors. At least Carrie had one possible answer, and a name, palynacusis, to account for Abington's strange behavior. Such a bizarre and unusual disorder. She could imagine how anyone would get agitated, believing someone was yelling the same thing over and over again in your ear. And you could not see the person who was doing the yelling or where it was coming from. It was an illusion. The implications were troubling.
The condition indicated a localized disturbance in the brain, specifically the part of the temporal lobe that processed auditory information. Carrie returned to the idea that the condition could be a side effect of DBS. It would mean Abington's confused agitation was not the commonly encountered post-op delirium, a temporary consequence of anesthesia or other drugs. Carrie needed to see Abington, to examine him further, but obstacles blocked her way, namely Goodwin and Navarro. She saw another path forward. This one involved a friend, perhaps her only one at the VA. Chapter 24. The timing could not have been better. Functioning as Dr. Finley's private DBS surgeon, Carrie had no clinic responsibilities, but he had sent her an email to ask her to join him this morning because of a specific case on the schedule, one of his first patients who had undergone DBS for PTSD. The stars appeared to have aligned just for her. Carrie had replayed her conversation with Abington dozens of times in her head. She had no doubt that he had repeated the phrase, "follow my light," numerous times, and seemed to answer her question each time he thought it was asked. But that was not proof of palynacusis. Since Abington was off limits, the best way to learn more, Carrie concluded, was to see another patient like him. Dr. Finley's email was like manna from heaven. At this point, Carrie's investigation into palynacusis was nothing more than an intellectual challenge. She simply wanted to know if the behavior ever manifested in others, or if Abington was truly an outlier. She was not in a position yet to broach the subject with Dr. Finley. Her confidence was nowhere near where it should be, and any claims made had to be based on evidence, not conjecture. She had found nothing that reported auditory illusions in DBS cases treated for Parkinson's or other movement disorders. But with these PTSD patients, electrodes were being placed in a completely different area of the brain, the amygdala nucleus. Carrie pondered this. The amygdala was not generally associated with hearing perception. She knew that. But this was an experimental program, and the brain was still an organ of profound mysteries. Carrie was scheduled to meet with Dr. Finley on Wednesday morning, after the general neurology clinic. Dr. Finley was supposed to supervise the neurology clinic, which was otherwise run largely by the residents who rotated on 3-month shifts through the VA. But Finley's increasing commitments to the deep brain stimulation program had gradually displaced his direct teaching and supervisory obligations. And on a typical Wednesday, he would hold court from his office, making himself available as needed for residents. For the most part, the residents preferred to leave him alone and solve clinical problems by themselves. Carrie had attended just one clinical round since she joined the VA's rank and file, but the DBS patients she saw that day were being treated for movement disorders, not PTSD. She had no way to correlate those patients to Steve Abington's condition. Traumatic brain injury patients comprised the majority of cases Carrie observed, with cognitive, perceptual, and language deficits usually accompanied by a hemi or quadriparesis or seizures. Those patients whose foremost symptoms were post-traumatic stress were often referred to the psychiatry clinic, which was bursting through its seams. Everyone realized these veterans were suffering from a brain disorder, but treatment was limited to antidepressants, anti-anxiety medication, or ineffective psychotropics. Acceptance into the DBS program was extremely limited during these early clinical stages, and the pent-up demand dwarfed the number of operations performed to date. Unless humanity put an end to war, likely only if humanity put an end to itself, a cure for PTSD seemed the only palliative measure for the VA's mushrooming resource woes. Carrie arrived at Dr. Finley's office 5 minutes after the clinical rounds concluded and gently knocked on his door. She worried about interrupting him, but he threw the door open as if in anticipation. A reassuring smile eased much of her concern, and he was filled with effervescence. "Really exciting day, Carrie. I've just been reviewing the neuropsych tests on Ramon. We are clearly on track. Look at this." He handed Carrie a bulging manila folder full of test results and graphics referencing one Ramon Hernandez, a 32-year-old male and a veteran of war in Afghanistan. Carrie leafed through the studies. "He was one of our first DBS cases because he failed all the usual therapies," Dr. Finley said. "I remember that Sam Rockwell had some difficulties with his surgery and actually had to reposition the stimulating electrode several times before we got adequate signals from the amygdala. But fortunately, there were no obvious complications." "No, follow my light," Carrie thought.
No arrhythmia. With an expression like a proud papa's, Dr. Finley went on.
Ramon Hernandez has gone from living on the streets or in jail to holding a respectable job as a logistics analyst for a Target distribution center. He's still on cetraline, 150 milligrams, but the Oxycontin, benzos, and beta blockers are gone, and he regularly attends the weekly counseling sessions with his clinical social worker. Last I heard, he's even got a girlfriend.
Lifting the folder, Dr. Finley said,
This battery of psychometrics documents Ramon's impressive progress. In addition to the MMPI, we concentrated mostly on tests of all aspects of memory function, emotional intelligence, and executive functioning. There's an alexithymia scale.
Carey was familiar with the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, or MMPI, but had not heard of the alexithymia scale and asked Dr. Finley to clarify.
It's when people have difficulty describing and expressing their own emotions, Dr. Finley said. Kind of a measure of how people are in touch with their feelings. It's a useful addition to other tests of emotional intelligence and frustration tolerance. They're far from perfect, but we get a pretty good picture of someone's personality when we analyze the entire test battery results.
Adam didn't seem to have that much difficulty there, Carrie thought. He seemed as caring and understanding as ever. But she could not deny his explosiveness, as seen in David's bloodied nose and the damage Adam had inflicted on his Camaro. Adam was a firework of violence, awaiting only a match.
You thought Don McCall was impressive, Dr. Finley said. Wait until you meet Ramon.
Chapter 25. The Department of Neurology and Neurosurgery at the VA occupied an H-shaped section of the second floor in the main building. There was some talk that the department would move if they ever finished construction on the annex, but that was a very big if. While it was a bit cramped, there was a certain convenience to having the surgical suites and the neurology exam rooms all in close proximity. Dr. Finley led Carrie at a brisk pace to Exam Room 5 in the neurology unit. The exam room was like most Carrie had been in over the years, not that different from the one where she'd almost died. It had a waist-high counter, a sink, and various instruments for checking vitals. Seated in the aluminum chair next to the examination table was a clean-cut, neatly but casually dressed and well-groomed Hispanic gentleman who stood and shook hands with Dr. Finley. He was powerfully built and quite handsome, Carrie noted.
Hey, Doc, good to see you.
He spoke with a youthful and vibrant voice, the voice of somebody excited for the future. Carrie had to look carefully to see the slight asymmetry of the neck where the stimulating wires had been tunneled from the scalp, running down beneath his right clavicle to attach to the battery pack in his upper chest.
This is Dr. Carrie Bryant, who has taken over for Dr. Rockwell.
Yeah, I heard about his accident, Ramon said. Horrible. He was a terrific guy.
Nice to meet you, Dr. Bryant. You've got big shoes to fill.
Ramon's hand, half the size of a baseball mitt, swallowed Carrie's as he gave her a firm but gentle handshake.
I've heard only great things about Dr. Rockwell, Carrie said.
Mind if she examines you, Ramon?
Be my guest, Ramon said. But I can probably examine myself by now.
Carrie resisted the urge to come right out and ask if he ever heard the same words spoken over and over again. Her old pal Val would say Carrie possessed all the subtlety of a jackhammer. Carrie proceeded through a series of questions pertaining to Ramon's current lifestyle. It was clear that he was socially appropriate, concentrated well, and attended to questions with insight and flexibility. He enjoyed his work and even gave some thought to getting married to his longtime girlfriend.
Considering she could have charged me with domestic assault not that long ago, I'd say I've come a long way.
Ramon's smile projected the kind of cocky confidence required for the battlefield.
Can you elaborate? Carrie asked.
How far had Ramon really come, she wanted to know.
I used to get drunk and jealous. I hit her. More than once. Not something I'm proud of, obviously. Once I got my anger under control with the DBS, I could actually listen to what my therapists were trying to tell me.
And that is?
But I was trying to control her because I was really afraid I was going to lose her.
The insight impressed Carrie, but she was curious to see how he would react to questions about his war memories. What happened during that ambush? Do you mind talking about it?
Ramon's eyes flashed, but he just shrugged. Honestly, I don't remember all of it.
Share what you can, Carrie said.
I was stationed at Camp Dwyer in the Helmand province, a place we lovingly referred to as Hellman. Luxury there was a sandbag that could double as a couch, Ramon said, with the detachment of a newscaster. We were on a scouting mission, looking for a terrorist named Nasser Umari. He was a big-time anti-coalition dickhead, pardon my language. Hooked up with the Taliban and other militant groups, too, I suppose. We had just fast-roped from an MH-47 helicopter, did our patrols, and after that, exfiltrated back toward our extraction point. There were about 15 of us in the fire team. He paused to remember. Yeah, about 15. It was the usual oven hot that day. A few more degrees and the sand would have turned to glass. We had just vaulted a mud wall in what looked like an abandoned town when machine gun fire seemed to come out of nowhere. Me and three other guys fell back into an alley where I figured we'd get a better read on the enemy position, but the Taliban had machine gun positions all around, and next thing I knew, I got shot in the arm. Hurt like a mother, you know what. Ramon rolled up the sleeve on his white cotton t-shirt to show Carrie a scar on his bulging trapezius, a little bigger than a quarter. She was sure his body was riddled with other scars that had nothing to do with DBS surgery. Ramon continued. We were returning fire, but I had crawled into a doorway to try and clot the wound. Next thing I knew, an RPG struck our position, and two of the guys in the alley with me couldn't have an open casket at their wakes. It was that fast, but I guess that's war. The bad guys are after us, and we're after them. Kill or be killed, right?
Carrie was taken by how calm and controlled Ramon seemed. She saw no reticence or protectiveness. He remained focused, his mind targeted in the present, the past trauma mitigated by perspective. She was duly impressed. If emotion was a color, Ramon's ambush had been rendered in simple black and white. So, what sort of problems are you having? Carrie asked. Ramon gave this some thoughtful consideration.
Well, sometimes I don't seem to care about things all that much, he eventually confessed. I don't get as worked up about a lot of things that used to bother me either. Mostly that's good, but I wonder if sometimes I'm too relaxed. If I get behind in work, I don't seem to care or worry that much. That's not me, and I don't remember a lot about my time in Afghanistan. I mean, I do, but I don't. There's lots of holes. People have to tell me things, and sometimes it doesn't make sense, but I can live with that.
What about your hearing? Do you hear voices? Carrie asked.
No.
How about hearing sounds or voices that you know are real, but they seem to go on in your head, like an echo that never stops? Dr. Finley looked at Carrie, nonplussed. She knew these questions would produce that kind of reaction. They were way off base for this sort of exam, but Dr. Finley did not intervene.
No, Ramon said.
Carrie went on to complete her examination, standard bedside tests of memory and cognition that she knew he would pass with flying colors. She analyzed his vision and eye movements, his hearing, speech, and swallowing. His motor functioning, gait, sensation, and reflexes were all perfectly normal. Thanks, she said. It was a real pleasure meeting and talking with you, and thank you for your service.
My pleasure. See you again, and good luck with the program.
She shook hands again, and Carrie followed Dr. Finley out of the exam room. Dr. Finley had more to discuss with Ramon, but he said he wanted to speak with Carrie in private first.
Amazing, right?
I'm truly astounded, Carrie said. Dr. Finley's pride and enthusiasm were infectious, but Carrie could not embrace the moment to his degree. Ramon had reinvigorated her mojo, but her curiosity had not been fully satiated. Was Steve Abington ever diagnosed with schizophrenia? Any history of the disease in his family? Dr. Finley thought on it and shook his head.
No. Why do you ask?
Just curious, Carrie said. The answer was expected and did nothing to waylay her concerns. Post-op delirium? Or some strange side effect to DBS? It was impossible for her to say. Carrie contemplated her next move. She was scheduled to be back in the OR on Friday for a DBS surgery on a Marine named Eric Fasciani.
Before she could share Dr. Finley's enthusiasm completely, she had to see whether the condition happened again. If she were careful, Carrie could go see that patient post-op, and Goodwin would never be the wiser. Chapter 26. Carrie had never acquired much of a taste for alcohol. She seldom drank, but on Friday night, 2 days after meeting Ramon Hernandez, she sat alone in a booth at Bertucci's and sipped from her glass of Sauvignon Blanc. Her thoughts were dim from fatigue. She had spent 7 grueling hours on her feet performing another successful DBS surgery on Eric Fasciani. The operation had gone smoothly enough, and it was easy to see how her job could become routine. 2 Parkinson's cases were already on the schedule for next week, and they would be virtually identical procedures. Today, it had been Eric Fasciani's turn on the table, and depending on what Carrie found out, it could change everything. A middle-aged waitress with a kind face and friendly smile scuttled past Carrie's table, but backtracked when she noticed the empty wine glass. "Do you want another?" She cleared the glass along with the remains of Carrie's salad meal. "Maybe some dessert? The chocolate mousse is amazing."
"Sounds tempting," Carrie said.
"But I'll just get a coffee. Black." The waitress departed, and Carrie checked the hour on her smartphone and frowned. She was eager to get to Fasciani on the neuro recovery floor, but it was too early to see him. Her latest DBS patient represented a possible answer to the Steve Abington mystery, but he would be too heavily sedated for Carrie to properly evaluate. She needed him more alert. Fasciani's operation had been long, but without incident. At the advice of Dr. Finley, Carrie had skipped pre-op consultation altogether. Better for her nerves, it was thought. Instead of greeting a troubled and nervous patient, Carrie saw only a shaved, bald-headed young man, deeply sedated and intubated, with his endotracheal tube tied to a ventilator, and an IV drip open to KVO. It was probably better this way, and it fit right in with Dr. Goodwin's view of her role as hired help. Carrie was a technician, not a doctor. At least Dr. Finley had briefed her on the poor fellow's history.
3 tours in Afghanistan, but it was the last one that did him in, Dr. Finley had said. Apparently the attack was highly organized. 150 Taliban came running down the hillsides from 4 directions and riddled his base with gunfire and RPGs.
Carrie wondered if anybody came back from the war unchanged.
The outpost went up in flames, Dr. Finley continued. After this, he was a quivering wreck. He couldn't sleep without his dead buddies waking him in a sweat. They med-flighted him out of there and eventually got him back home to Worcester. But he failed re-entry miserably. He suffers from horrible flashbacks and daily panic attacks. We actually found him on the street, living out of an old shopping cart. We've got him in a shelter now, but he's made little progress.
Carrie felt a fleeting sense of gratitude. Adam had a home, loving and helpful parents, and her. She looked over at Fasciani and saw the scars and needle tracks in his arms and neck, and the dozens of skin-raising scars on his limbs and trunk. One of his demons was heroin.
He hasn't done too well with talk therapy, Dr. Finley added. And most of the time, his blood work comes back with no evidence that he's even taking the antidepressants we prescribed. Just Valium, alcohol, Oxycontin, and other opiates. So, in this case, Carrie, DBS is not just a treatment. It's his only hope, a prayer.
The surgery was Abington Redux. The small burr holes for fixing the stereotactic frame, the CT scan and superimposed computerized mapping with his earlier MRI images. The 14-millimeter burr hole placed just where the images told her to drill. The cannula driven through to the basolateral nucleus of the amygdala. Finally, the electrodes, only to await Dr. Finley's confident voice coming up from the monitor on the other side of the table.
Great, Carrie. Precise and perfect signals. Lock him in.
After, Dr. Finley and Carrie had met outside the OR. Her boss was beaming with pride, overjoyed.
This is your second case this week, and you are, in a word, terrific, Dr. Finley said. Trust me, Carrie, you have what it takes to do this. You're a machine. I mean, despite all those computerized gizmos, a lot of times Dr. Rockwell had to reposition the cannula, 3 or more passes at times, and I always worried about an increased risk of infection or hemorrhage. But with you, I'm sure we've got those electrodes placed where they need to be,
and I'm just that much more confident in the results.
From the corner of her eye, Carrie could see Eric Fasciani's stretcher being wheeled into the elevator on its way up to the third floor, neuro post-op ICU.
Thanks for the vote of confidence, she said.
Rockwell's a fine doc, Dr. Findlay said, and I pray he makes a full recovery. But no matter what happens, I think you've got his job.
Carrie blushed, a little uncomfortable that her good fortune had come at another's misfortune. She politely refused Dr. Finley's invitation to dinner, instead heading off on her own to kill time.
That was 3 hours ago.
Carrie checked her smartphone once more, paid her bill in cash, including a hefty tip, and slid out of the booth. As she hurried to her car, she thought, if Fasciani exhibits the same symptoms as Abington, nobody is going to have Sam Rockwell's job. Chapter 27. The doctor's parking lot at the VA was virtually deserted when Carrie drove up in her trusty Subaru. She parked some distance from the entrance, out of the way of prying eyes. Only the residents on call spaces were occupied, and somebody working for Navarro might recognize Carrie's car. That could lead to questions, and Carrie's workday had technically ended the moment Fasciani got wheeled out of the OR. A little extra precaution was the right prescription for this evening's unsanctioned jaunt. The VA was not in the best neighborhood, and the quiet of the surrounding streets set Carrie on edge. A biting wind rippled the plastic sheets draped over the long-neglected scaffolding that framed much of the darkened annex. Carrie did not know if the VA's administrators were counting on continued DARPA funds to get construction going again, but she had her suspicions. Carrie pinned a clipboard to her side with one arm and shielded her hands from the cold within the thin fabric pockets of her long white lab coat. Some spring. Beneath her coat, Carrie wore a clean pair of blue scrubs. She needed to look official, here on hospital business. The automatic doors at the rear hospital entrance swooshed open as Carrie approached. Once inside, Carrie scuttled past the lone security guard stationed at a wooden podium with a quick flash of her hospital ID. To him, she was another doc on the job and nothing more. The VA's empty corridors amplified Carrie's footsteps. At this hour, BCH would have been bustling, and Carrie was reminded of the days when ambulances arrived in steady streams, hauling everything from panic attacks to gunshot wounds. On her way to the elevator, Carrie spied a young woman dressed in green scrubs who approached from the opposite direction. She could have been one of Navarro's, but Carrie did not take a close look to confirm. With the clipboard to her face, Carrie lowered her head and pretended to study something important. The ruse worked. Not a glance. Not even a hitch in the other woman's stride. The experience made Carrie feel a little bit foolish. She was a surgeon, not some fly-by-night medical detective. It was all a bit absurd, but exhilarating at the same time. Most of her life, Carrie had been a rule follower, not breaker, but in this instance, she felt justified and believed her actions were absolutely necessary. Carrie quickened her pace and was a bit breathless when she reached the elevators. Moments later, Carrie was back on neuro recovery. She pushed the intercom and waited for the duty nurse to unlock the double doors securing access to the unit. Carrie heard a faint click, pulled on the door handle, and headed inside. Marianne was off tonight, apparently, and a different nurse occupied the nurse's station. Carrie did not recognize the attractive black male in his 30s who was too busy charting to bother to look at whom he buzzed inside.
Good evening, Carrie said.
The man glanced up from his monitor. He had a handsome face and almond-shaped eyes the color of dark caramel. Carrie's eyes dropped to his ID badge, but it was concealed by shadows and impossible to read.
Quiet night tonight, Carrie said.
Only one doc was supposed to be doing rounds, and it was certainly not Carrie. For this reason alone, Carrie would have preferred to avoid conversation altogether, but that would have come across as odd. Nurses expected a bit of small talk from the doctors.
Only got one patient on the floor tonight, the nurse said.
His resonant voice sounded neither pleased nor bothered by the lack of activity. Abington had also been the only patient on the floor the night Carrie visited, which pinged her curiosity. Were vets slated for DBS surgery specifically on days when no other major neurosurgeries were scheduled? It would make sense to isolate them, given how agitated and volatile these patients could become. Either way, the scheduling practice worked in Carrie's favor.
How's our patient doing?
He's been pretty quiet, but these vets aren't in the best shape to begin with.
I'm just gonna pop in and check on him. I'm the surgeon who did his DBS installation.
Mm-hmm.
The nurse could not have sounded less impressed if he tried. On a whim, Carrie decided to secure a little extra insurance on her clandestine visit. What's your name? She asked. The nurse returned a wary glance. Docs do not always bother with such pleasantries.
Lee Taggart,
he said, holding up his badge for Carrie to see and read. Look, Lee, Carrie said, leaning over the nurse's station to deliver her message. I'd appreciate it if you kept my visit here a secret. I'm really supposed to let the residents handle things, but I guess I'm a bit of a control freak. Carrie flashed a playful smile that did not appear to soften Lee any. She got the distinct impression that Lee Taggart did not care about hospital politics in any way, shape, or form, so long as his checks cleared.
You do what you need to do, Taggart said as his focus returned to his charts. I don't tell people anything they don't ask or need to know.
Carrie gave Taggart an appreciative smile he did not see, and left. 15 steps later, she was inside Fasciani's room. These hospital quarters were nothing but glass cubicles with a freestanding wardrobe closet and a flimsy curtain for privacy. The patients were kept isolated to reduce the spread of infection, and while there were not many rooms to choose from, Carrie observed that Fasciani occupied the same bed as Abington had before his transfer to Med-ICU. A gooseneck lamp mounted above Fasciani's hospital bed illuminated his face enough to show Carrie his glassy-eyed stare. He was awake, and Carrie commended herself for getting the timing of the anesthesia right. She closed the door, pulled the curtain shut, and turned on the overhead fluorescent. Fasciani's eyes were sunken and ringed with dark circles. His hollow cheeks, missing teeth, and shaved head made him look more like a POW than a hospital patient. At least Fasciani did not have that accusatory stare and look of terror she had seen in Steve Abington's eyes. Maybe this was all for naught. She would know soon enough. Carrie approached Fasciani's bed and spoke in a whisper. I'm Dr. Bryant, Eric. I did the surgery on you earlier today. Nothing. If anything, his vacant gaze worked harder to penetrate the wall in front of him. I just came to check on you, Carrie said, resting her hands on the bed railing. I hope you're doing okay. Sometimes patients feel a little nauseated from the anesthesia right about now, and I suspect you have a bit of a headache. More silence. Fasciani's only response, if it could be called that, was to turn his head away from Carrie. His movements came in slow motion. Carrie's stomach tightened and her earlier confidence fell away. She thought of only one cause for such languorous motility. He's still too sedated, damn it. She was certain she had given him enough recovery time. This many hours post-op, Fasciani should have been coherent enough to play checkers. In his current condition, there would be no way for Carrie to effectively evaluate him. She doubted Fasciani would spend another night in the neuro-ICU. If Carrie was going to evaluate him, it needed to be tonight. She had no other option. Carrie would have to retreat and come back later. Her curiosity had become its own gravitational force. She hoped whoever worked the overnight shift would be as accommodating as Lee Taggart. Carrie came around to the front of the bed and examined his chart. With a quick scan of his meds, she saw the problem right away. Valium, a lot of it. Fasciani must have become agitated at some point, and the nurse had wisely put him under. Evidently, Lee Taggart thought an infusion of a major sedative was a detail Carrie did not need to know, and certainly she had not thought to ask. Well, at least she could trust the tight-lipped nurse to keep her visit here a secret. Damn it again. The situation was essentially hopeless. Fasciani was going to spend the night sedated. Carrie could come back at midnight or 2 in the morning, and it would not make a difference. Though daunted, Carrie was not ready to give up. She had inherited her mother's willful determination. Addressing Fasciani from the foot of the bed, Carrie asked, Eric, can you tell me how you're feeling? He gave no response, but Carrie expected none. She went around to the left side of the bed to check Fasciani's pupil reaction to her pen light and saw that his lips looked dry and chapped. She smoothed an ice chip taken from a plastic cup at his bedside over his cracked lips like a healing balm. Fasciani's empty stare went beyond 1,000 yards. After several passes with the ice, Asciani turned away from Carrie. His movements slowed by the drugs in his system and came to a rest with his head facing the door. Carrie wondered if he was going to call for the nurse, but Fasciani was so doped up she doubted he even knew where he was. She decided to make one more attempt, though it was an obvious sucker's bet. She went around to the other side of the bed so she could look him in the eyes. "Eric, I want to help you," Carrie said. Her voice cracked slightly under the strain of emotion. The pang in her chest felt like heartbreak. Her deep compassion went far beyond her duty as a doctor. The rawness of these feelings came from Adam. She heard echoes of her brother and Fasciani's struggles, Abington's too. And while Adam seemed to be coping, a distinct possibility remained that he could one day fall into the abyss, first to the streets, then to drugs, the shelters, and eventually maybe to some hospital bed at the VA, with or without wires in his brain. In this way, Fasciani was not just another wounded vet. He was like family. Fasciani's bedsheets rustled as he turned away from Carrie to face the wall opposite the door. This time his movement struck Carrie as a bit strange. Did he just turn away intentionally? Carrie waited a moment, perhaps as long as 2 minutes, purposefully silent. When enough time passed, she repositioned Fasciani's head so he again faced the door. He offered no resistance and stayed with his head in that direction, unmoving, hardly blinking. She took a couple steps toward the door. "Eric, can you hear me?" she asked. 1 second, then two, then three, then... Fasciani turned his head and faced the wall opposite the door. "Twice, that's nothing," Carrie thought. "I spoke and he turned his head away from my voice twice. It could just be a coincidence." For a third time, Carrie repositioned Fasciani's head to face the door. Again, she spoke. "Eric, can you hear me?" To herself, Carrie counted 1 and 2 and 3. Fasciani showed Carrie the back of his head as he again faced the wall opposite the door. She repeated the test again with the same result. She spoke to Fasciani from the right side of the bed, and he turned his head to the left. Carrie said, "Holy crap! It's as though he's hearing my voice from that side of the room." Carrie tested him one more time, but in a different way. "Eric, I want you to answer me each time you hear this," she said. Fasciani repositioned his head to face left and mumbled in a groggy, drug-slurred voice, "I hear you. I hear you. Carrie's breath caught. This was classic and just what she had read in the literature. Many patients were able to localize their illusion to the side opposite the pathology in the brain. She felt certain that the auditory processing of the right temporal lobe in Fasciani's brain was not working right. Carrie's training kicked in as she battled to slow her thinking. She did not want to be reactive, but found it hard to control her emotions. Abington and Fasciani both exhibited symptoms of palynecusis, and the commonality was DBS. But was that the root cause? Carrie could not say with certainty. Again, she went back to a hemorrhage, but could there be a stroke from a blocked blood vessel? She wanted a CT scan or MRI stat, an EEG, too. Could it be a seizure or something else? Why didn't Ramon experience anything like this, or had he, and his memory was fogged? Carrie felt urgency and curiosity, but also anger. She was trapped. She had no business being here and had no one to call on for help. She couldn't even order these tests without Goodwin torpedoing her career. She had no authority to intervene unless she went to Dr. Finley. But what then? "Hi, boss. Sorry I put your program in the hospital at risk by acting like a resident when I haven't been credentialed." That could create all sorts of problems. At a minimum, Dr. Finley would have to make some excuse for Carrie examining Fasciani, or he'd simply lie and say that he himself had followed up on the patients. But Dr. Finley was not even a surgeon, and that explanation, Carrie knew, would not wash. Before Carrie could approach Dr. Finley, she needed more specifics. The worst thing she could do would be nothing at all. The second worst thing would be to make some wild claim about a huge DBS side effect, one that nobody else had noticed before, without any supporting evidence. Her credibility was still in the repair stages, and Carrie was already on unstable ground. She thought she was onto something, but what? She could not do anything about it at 9:30 at night. Unless... An idea came to Carrie so ingenious her whole body tensed. The next shift was due to come on at 11 o'clock. Carrie could go home, call the duty nurse, and order a CAT scan using Dr. Navarro's hospital ID. It was pinned to the nurse's station for everyone to see. It was a risky move, but asking for a scan was not like ordering narcotics. She could say that Navarro had personally asked her to call in the labs. Chances were nobody would question the order. If the nurse on the next shift was anything like Lee Taggart, it was almost a certainty. The scan could be done overnight or very early in the morning. Carrie would go by radiology first thing and have a look at the films herself. No one was likely to see her if she showed up early enough. Once she checked out the CAT scan and the EEG, she'd decide what to do from there. Carrie gently touched Vashiani's face. His skin felt spongy, no give. Her heart ached for him. Something had to be done. It was not perfect, but at least it was a plan. Chapter 28. A glance at the speedometer showed Carrie was going 70. Her thoughts raced, and it was no surprise the surge of adrenaline had her driving so fast. Carrie checked the time on the dashboard clock. In 30 minutes, she could make the call she had rehearsed into memory. The radio was off, but Carrie's fingers drummed an erratic rhythm against the steering wheel as she exited the highway. Her thoughts returned to Fasciani, Abington, and this bizarre palinacusis. The implications of the discovery both exhilarated and bewildered her. DBS sat at the epicenter of a renaissance in psychosurgery, a groundswell that Carrie's discovery might disrupt. It was the last outcome Dr. Finley had imagined when he brought her on board. Carrie kept to the speed limit and arrived home at 10:45, leaving 15 minutes until shift change and showtime. It was difficult not to project into the future. If DBS proved detrimental in the way she suspected, it would put an immediate halt to Dr. Finley's pilot program and put her right out of a job. What she was about to do carried a burden of guilt, lots of it. Dr. Finley had given her a second chance. And here she was, going behind his back, working covertly to dismantle what might be Nobel Prize-worthy work in the treatment of PTSD. While the surgical community had embraced DBS as a neurosurgical treatment for a variety of ailments, the public would key in on the brain damage it caused and would have a hard time not seeing the procedure as a hearkening back to the days of rusty implements and drooling, mindless patients. Some side effects to experimental surgery would be tolerable, but palinacusis was not one of them. The extremely rare condition made it impossible for anyone to function, with bodiless voices constantly shouting in one ear. If it was not a fate worse than death, it sure was close. Irene Bryant was in the living room working on a painting when Carrie arrived. Adam was stretched out on the sofa. Dressed in gray shorts and a loose-fitting t-shirt, he struck a Rubenesque pose as he munched on an apple. If only he were as plump and healthy-looking as those models. After hanging up her coat, Carrie came around to the front of the easel. She fully expected Adam would be part of her mother's creation, but Irene had painted only the bowl of fruit on the coffee table. It was so realistic looking, it tricked Carrie's mind into smelling citrus mixed in with the scent of fresh oil paint. "It's beautiful, Mom," Carrie said. Standing beside Carrie, Irene appraised her work thoughtfully, body akimbo. "I'm thinking of calling it Bowl of Fruit." "Very clever title," Carrie said. She pointed to an apple in the fruit bowl. "May I?" Carrie asked. She had eaten only a salad for dinner and her belly was rumbling. She needed something to settle her stomach before making the call, and her mother's painting had given her a craving for fruit. "My work here is done, so be my guest." Adam tossed Carrie an apple. She noticed the tips of her brother's fingers were blackened with engine grease, which she somehow managed to keep off of the furniture, but not her apple. Carrie tossed the apple back to her brother. "I'll get my own, thanks."
"I almost got the beast running today," Adam said.
The distant look in Adam's eyes and his downcast expression caused Irene's bright smile to retreat. It made Carrie sad, thinking how this must be for her mother. Adam's past was stunting his potential, his future, and the mental shackles he wore kept him in a seemingly inescapable limbo. Here was Carrie, at the helm of a major mental health breakthrough, in a position to help Adam and others like him. But she was about to do the exact opposite. Irene turned her attention to Carrie and fixed her daughter with a worried stare. Irene's ability to see what others missed made her gifted at the campus, as well as a difficult parent to hide from. Carrie had learned that lesson the hard way in her rebellious middle school years, most notably the one and only time she came home a little tipsy from a friend's house. Her mother's powers of observation never failed to amaze.
Perhaps Carrie had inherited some of that talent, and it allowed her to see in Abington and Fasciani what others at the VA had not.
"Is something wrong, sweetheart?" Irene asked.
"I'm just about to blow my future up again," Carrie thought. "Mine and Adam's."
"No, I'm fine," was all Carrie managed.
"Good day?"
"Great, but I'm gonna turn in. Big day tomorrow."
"Maybe the biggest, depending on what those tests show or don't show."
"Yeah, me too," Adam said, sounding sarcastic. "I'm gonna do nothing, and then in the afternoon I have a big heap of nothing on my plate."
Irene shot Adam a slightly disapproving look, only because the truth in his humor hurt. Adam had nothing to do except work on that car of his. He could not hold a job, see his friends, or concentrate on a task without his frustration and pent-up anger getting the better of him.
Carrie crossed the room, wrapped her arms around her brother, and gave him a kiss on the forehead.
"I love you, brother," Carrie said. "And we're going to get through this together."
Adam returned a weak smile that seemed to contradict her conviction.
"Maybe in my next life," he said.
The guilt returned. The ache of betrayal, of secrets Carrie would have to keep, weighed heavy and would probably grow more burdensome over time. As she headed for the stairs, Carrie paused to apply a quick peck on her mother's cheek. The look Carrie got in response said her loving gesture hadn't lightened her mother's lingering concern. Carrie bounded up the stairs and closed her bedroom door behind her.
Home again,
but not home, not really. This was transient living. Carrie's life was in flux, much like Adam's. Carrie sat on her bed with her smartphone in hand. She did not know the VA's phone number by memory, and after looking it up, wrote it down on the same scratch paper where she had earlier jotted Navarro's hospital ID and his username password combination. Navarro had posted those numbers as a personal convenience, so he would not have to approve and enter every lab order from a resident. It was a bit lazy, but not at all an uncommon practice. Still, Carrie did not want to keep Navarro's login credentials on her smartphone, lest Goodwin employed hackers as spies. She could not be too cautious. Carrie knew without checking that her pupils were slightly dilated and her heartbeat accelerated, all neurological responses to stress. Intellectually, she understood that her sympathetic nervous system was causing a biochemical imbalance, not that the knowledge reduced her anxiety any. The phone rang. Her hands turned clammy. The operator answered.
"VA, can I help you?"
"Yes, neuro recovery ICU, please."
"One moment."
A beat of silence preceded the phone ringing once again. Carrie took a breath and exhaled slowly. She studied Navarro's ID number, committing the digits to memory.
"You can do this. Just sound confident."
Another ring. Carrie tensed, gripping her phone even tighter, but the phone kept on ringing. No answer. Where's the duty nurse? Carrie considered the possibility that Fasciani had suffered a setback. Maybe he was being triaged at that moment, or he could have coded. Naturally, Carrie's mind went to the worst possible outcomes. Was it related to the DBS? Carrie waited 15 minutes, then called back. The operator connected her to the unit for a second time. By 12:30, after three attempts to reach the duty nurse, Carrie was an emotional wreck. Something horrible was happening to Eric Fasciani. She felt certain of it. She dialed the operator once more.
"This is Dr. Carrie Bryant," she announced. "Could you please page the duty nurse on the neuro recovery ICU and have whoever it is call me back ASAP?
Carrie gave the operator her number and waited anxiously for the call back. When her phone finally rang some 17 minutes later, she was on the floor trying to stretch out a bit of tightness in her legs and back. Days after Abington's unprovoked assault, Carrie still felt a persistent ache. She should have gone downstairs and grabbed something to eat, but Adam was up watching television, and Carrie was in no mood to confront her guilt again. She staved off a bout of lightheadedness from having stood too quickly and answered the call.
"This is Dr. Bryant," Carrie said into the phone. Yeah, Dr. Bryant, this is Mandy, the operator here.
Mandy? Carrie was confused. Where's the duty nurse?
Okay, was all Carrie could think to say. There's nobody up on the ICU neuro recovery floor. The lightheadedness Carrie had experienced returned with a vengeance.
What do you mean? That's impossible. I was just visiting a patient there not more than a few hours ago.
Mandy made a bit of an exasperated sigh, as if to imply the docs never knew what was really going on.
That may very well be, Mandy said, but there ain't no patients up there now. Security checked it for me. The lights are out, the doors are locked, and nobody is home.
Chapter 29. Carrie kept a light foot on the gas on her early morning drive back to the VA. She had espresso for blood.
The notion that Fasciani had somehow gotten up and walked away from neuro recovery simply did not compute.
Could Fasciani have had a medical emergency like Abington's? Perhaps he coded, maybe an arrhythmia like Abington, and had been transferred to the med ICU, turfed, as Goodwin would call it.
DBS-induced palynacusis and arrhythmia?
Carrie could not dream up a more bizarre set of symptoms.
If Carrie could have called Lee Taggart or the duty nurse for the 11 o'clock shift from home, she would have. The problem was, Carrie did not have access to the scheduling application. She was Dr. Finley's employee and had no IT privileges. If she wanted to speak with the nursing staff, her only option was to return to the hospital.
Not a problem.
Carrie had reheated a burrito in the microwave, and a Red Bull would keep her alert for hours.
Besides, this would give her an excuse to go to the med ICU to look for Fasciani and personally check up on Abington, assuming he was still a patient there. It would be easy enough to walk the floor without raising too many eyebrows. Her goal was modest and obtainable. She would get to work hours before everyone else, find out what she needed to know, and maybe grab a few hours' sleep in a vacant on-call room. A little past 1:30 in the morning, Carrie arrived at the VA and parked in the same spot she had occupied hours ago. Then it was back through the rear entrance with a head nod and a flash of her badge, this time to a different security guard. She raced down the hallway, eager to confirm what she already knew to be true. The hospital, like most of the patients here, seemed fast asleep. The elevator stopped on the third floor, and Carrie hurried out. In no time, she was back at the double doors to the neuro ICU. They were locked, but that was standard procedure. More unusual was the view through the windows built into the swinging doors. The hallway lights were off. The glow from various screensavers illuminated the nurse's station, enough for Carrie to see it was unoccupied.
Unoccupied? But why? What had happened to her patient? Not her patient, but rather Navarro's and Goodwin's.
If Fasciani was still in the hospital, and where else would he be? Carrie reasoned she would find him in the med ICU. He'd coded or something. The arrhythmia. It was the only logical explanation.
Soon, Carrie was standing outside the locked doors to the med ICU, looking through the glass into a well-lit active unit. Carrie buzzed the intercom and announced herself as Dr. Bryant. The doors unlocked, and Carrie strode over to the nurse's station. A black woman in her late 20s, hair pulled back, high cheekbones, pretty and slight, looked up from her monitor and gave Carrie a quiet smile.
Morning, doctor. What brings you here?
I just wanted to see if you had a patient by the name of Eric Fasciani brought here this evening. The woman, Dot, according to her name badge, clicked at her keyboard and shook her head slightly.
The name doesn't sound familiar.
No, I'm sorry, he's not here. Carrie's brow furrowed and her eyes narrowed into slits.
Where could he have gone?
She asked, is Steve Abington still here? Dot executed more key taps than a ticket broker at an airline counter. That slight frown returned.
We don't have Steve Abington here either, she said.
Well, he was transferred to the floor the day before yesterday. Dot checked her screen again, thinking she might have missed something.
I'm sorry, we don't have his record, so I can't tell you where he went.
Can we check the computer? Carrie asked.
Sorry, I can't do that, Dot said. This new electronic medical record system is great in some ways, but we're still in classes for access authorization. I've spent about 100 hours, and all I'm allowed to do now is input vitals and other nursing data.
Carrie was not the least bit surprised. She understood this all too well.
I can look up labs, Dot offered, but I still can't see things like patient demographics. Don't ask me why. Most everyone hates it, but I suspect we'll get the hang of it soon enough.
Carrie brightened. Could you